Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, October 21st, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, Money and Markets, and Ask Catherine, then a discussion with nutritionist and neurofeedback practitioner Nora Gagoudis. And I'm speaking to you from Silicon Valley in the San Francisco Bay Area. I've been enjoying working with strategic partners and seeing a lot of our network in the Bay Area. It's been a very exciting visit. I'm going to be here till approximately November 10th, and I really am enjoying myself. Tonight in Let's Go to the Movies, Adam Curtis's powerful documentary, The Century of Self. Our theme tonight is mortgages command the headlines. It's been mortgages since I talked to you last week. And in fact, I've been putting up regularly different stories and commentaries at the blog, but there's one that was quite remarkable coming from the market ticker by Carl Denninger, and it's called If This Is True, Kaboom. And after many, many years, more than a decade of trying to warn the financial markets about what's going on and the investment community about what's going on, I feel like I've made contact with the movies. I want to read some of this to you and then explain what it means to you and everything else going on, not just in the markets, but in the elections and politics. Here it goes. I don't know. Multiple people have told me this before. Catherine Austin Fitz has talked about this for a long time. I get whispers all the time from people who I know actually are involved in securitization work related to this on occasion and have for the last 3 years. We have the story from this morning from FDN talking about their software that has uncovered multiple sales of the same instruments. But this, if this is true, it's not just systemic, it's not just common, it was the premise and basis of the entire securitization game. And game is the correct word for it, as the allegations made here as that the entire thing was a gigantic scam. Now, he's talking about putting one mortgage into multiple pools again and again and again. He then quotes a whistleblower who's explaining some of the extent to which this was done. And then after the quote, he says, truth, I don't know. But it does fit with what we know. True securitization has so many fingers in the pie that I find it difficult or impossible to make the argument that it works compared to portfolio lending for the investor who is providing the funds. This sort of scenario also explains why everyone is resisting any attempt to provide the actual background documentation from origination forward to the assignment into the trust, and all we see are copies and loss note affidavits. True, actual wet signature notes with the endorsement they all claim they got, but which nobody has yet seen, leading one foreclosure defense attorney to quip that if someone ever does see such a note, they should bronze it, much as one would bronze their baby's first shoe pair. Couple more quotes, and then he says, if there are no actual original endorsed notes, well, then we need to get that fact into the open, to force into the open, because if it's true, this is the biggest fraud ever perpetrated in human history, and it permeates every single large financial institution in the Western world. Watch this clip again at 6:39 when Chris Whalen says Bear was selling the same note to multiple investors. So what you're seeing is the dawning of the realization that the system was not just corrupt, but the system itself at the core is fraudulent, and there is a profound disconnect between the amount of mortgages floating around in the capital markets and the actual homes with mortgages at the street level. Now, I said last week that I thought a federal moratorium was inappropriate and we needed to see the sheriffs exercise more control of the decisions as to whether there's a moratorium or the standards of paperwork used. And sure enough, we see the sheriff of Cook County announcing that he's going to insist on complete paperwork, and that's a very good sign to start to see the movement at the sheriff level. We have the New York Fed and PIMCO announcing that they are suing Bank of America. There's sort of an absurd situation. We're in the process of getting and posting the lawsuit. It was the Federal Reserve that, in essence, insisted that B of A buy Countrywide, which is the mortgage that is being sued about. It may be that PIMCO and the New York Fed, as investors, their hands are so tied by the documents that they literally need a court to give them the power to do the kinds of things they need if you're going to really work out some of these mortgages and some of these situations. But it is a very dangerous situation when an institution finds itself as both the regulator of a bank, an investor in a transaction with a bank where there are profound disagreements. So we're talking about some serious problems with the Fed acting as the bad bank. And of course, the question is, why can't we create a bad bank like we did in 1989? And the problem is, with fraud at this level, the criminal liability is very significant. Now, in Carl's piece, he grapples with what I said, the dawning realization of how bad things could be. He doesn't grapple with what this means to the derivatives market, because if it turns out that a multiple of your mortgages are fraudulent, then the derivatives leverage on top of that. So what does that mean to the derivatives? Well, it's even more scary. But I want to step back and say something that I've said several times already this week to various clients and people on our team. And that is, if you step back and pull out just and look at the whole economy, not just the mortgage situation, not just the derivative situation, it's the same problem over and over again, whether in mortgages, in currencies, in precious metals, in the stock market with sovereign bonds, with retirement benefits. In the real economy, we have a whole series of promises and contracts, and then if you go over into the symbolic economy, whether it's the media or government data or the financial markets, the paper economy has promised to many more people than actually exists. So the ETFs and the unallocated pools of precious metals have promised far more precious metals than actually exist, or that the servicers own and control for that specific vehicle. In the stock market, we see allegations of naked short selling. In other words, the brokerage system has sold more stock than actually has been authorized and issued by those enterprises. In the sovereign bond markets, disconnects and reports of more being owed than was actually on the books as issued. Retirement benefits, both in Europe and the United States. I talked a lot when I got back from Switzerland and Italy, the extent to which we have people who are betting on their pension funds or Social Security when, in fact, the assets supposedly supporting those arrangements have been drained off, ditto mortgages, ditto currency, ditto derivatives. And so we have this real gap between the real economy and the promises we've made to each other. And the challenge politically and financially is, how do you manage that disconnect? And of course, it's becoming more and more painful. Now, one of the great mysteries, and I keep coming back to this, is where did all this money go? Because whether it's this particular disconnect of selling multiple mortgages or one mortgage into multiple pools, or we're talking about the different kinds of frauds in the stock and bond market or printing currency, what we've done is we've soaked off trillions of dollars, and the great mystery is, where is that money gone? And it has not, despite what you read in the papers, it is not all gone to making the rich richer. It's far too much money. And it's also far too much money to just move capital to the emerging markets. And that's why I keep coming back to the black budget and how much money I think is disappearing down the black budget, because ultimately you can't resolve this issue with answering that question, where is this money going and why? So where has the money been going and why? How is the leverage going to be managed? I continue to say I don't think we're going to have a complete collapse. If you look at what the extent of the financial leverage, I don't see how you can get out of a deleveraging fast. And I don't think people want to, because liquid financial systems have brought a lot of value despite all the fraud. And so what we're trying to figure out is, how do you evolve through to a system that has more transparency and more integrity as to property rights? And, of course, that brings us to the big issue of the day, which is the rule of law. I posted a very good interview on the Ashcroft situation. The Obama administration is taking the position that Ashcroft can't be sued for breaking the law or violating the law. that he has immunity. This is on the torture and detention issues. We also have Angela Mazzello, just as Bank of America is being sued by the Fed and PIMCO for all the crappy paper in the Countrywide. We have Angela Mazzello, former head of Countrywide, who built it up into the the machinery it was, settling with the SEC civil charges and sort of getting a get-out-of-jail-free card, certainly paying an amount in fees that was significantly less than his total profits. His legal problems may be over, but it was remarkable to see it happen in the same week because it really sent a signal there is no accountability. Wall Street announced record pay is expected. Article by the Wall Street Journal, $145 billion, and really the message is, if we can pay for the liability of doing systemic fraud at the enterprise level with civil fines, as Goldman did, as other firms have done, and in an amount significantly less than our total profit, then basically we can protect individuals from engineering crime, and we're going to have to get them to do it, we're going to have to pay them very well. And so the message of all these different stories that look like totally different stories is the same story, which is the people who engineer and lead the systemic crime are being unbelievably well paid and are not being held accountable. They are, whether in government or in Wall Street at this point, above the law. So the great mystery of our time is going to be, how do we sort that out? Because the implications to the political system and the market system are pretty devastating. You stop, you know, if you look at the stock market, any multiple above a multiple of one depends on a general belief in the rule of law. So this is the tension, but it's not just the mortgage market; it's across the board. Okay, election, we're still neck and neck. It's really a fight to the finish with the Senate very much. Rasmussen now gives 48 to the Democrat, 47 to the Republican, but 5 completely in place. So this is going to, appears it's going to be right down to the wire. I'm hopeful that if we do get a Republican sweep, that it's going to slow down the 401k and IRA proposals. I don't think in the long run it makes much difference, because our big problem in that area is not, you know, the party politics. It's really the squeeze of trying to manage the disconnect between what retirees have been promised and how much money there is, and how you finance that. Do you finance it with more inflation, with more force, you know, forcing people abroad to finance it, or do you simply finance it with the retirement savings of the people you're making the payments to, which is at some point politically more feasible than the other alternatives. We have a special report on the annuity proposals. It's by looking at sort of what the proposals that Heritage or Brookings or some of the other think tanks make, that you get a feel for where this thing may be going, and I think it's helpful. That's for subscribers only for the first 30 days, so there's another 2 weeks where it's just available to you. Food and health, big shock. The FDA wrote letters to healthcare practitioners threatening chelation therapy, both, I believe, both intravenous and oral chelation therapy. That's a therapy I've used with enormous success, thanks to Dr. Laura Thompson. And it's very chilling to see the FDA making noise about that, because it's quite remarkable in its ability to help people detoxifying, as we've talked about before. Toxification and detoxifying are issues for all of us. In the bond markets, international tensions entered a new phase. We have a G20 summit in November in Korea. The G20 finance ministers and central bank governors are meeting for 2 days starting tomorrow. The Brazil finance minister announced he was staying home to deal with problems resulting from the currency appreciation in Brazil. They're putting special tax on foreigners just to keep foreign money out. These are the problems of success. And is insisting that Geithner move the currency issues up to the top of the agenda. The bottom line, the real economy is struggling to function with a currency system that's designed for harvesting instead of optimizing trade and the entrepreneurial process in the real economy. And it's a real tension, and it's going to, you know, that tension is not over. And as the economy struggles and cash flow diminish, the some of that economic warfare will be fought through the currency. We have a new report from Cliff High of Half Past Human. Several of you have asked me if I've read his latest report, and there was a new report out last night, so I have read that. He's very convinced that we'll have a major currency war in the crash of the dollar in November. We're just in a different universe. I think Cliff's work is unbelievably valuable, and I find it very useful and insightful to read. At the same time, I think he's reading the thoughts and sort of the psychic storm of millions of people who don't understand what has kept the dollar up over the last 50 years. And I think they significantly underestimate the staying power of the dollar. That's not to say the politics can't fall apart and we couldn't get a crash. I just continue to think we're in about a 70% chance of a continued slow burn. So I have a lot more faith in the slow burn. Now, the squabbling by the global leadership over the cash flows is clearly accelerating. It's going to get worse. And I do think after the election we're going to start a new, meaner phase. All the outsiders are vulnerable, and it's going to be a difficult transition. Cliff makes a great point in his report. I'll just read it to you. He says, "In my experience, crowds of irritated, ignorant people can be really dangerous. Thus, the coming months will be very dangerous times." And what he's talking about is the extent to which many of the people who have not understood the disconnect between the promises that they've been made or the paper they hold and the ability of the system to respect those rights or those benefits. If they don't understand the disconnect and they don't understand and have the big picture of what's going on, they're going to be very mad. And, sometimes I'm a lot more afraid of my angry, the neighbors that I have who are very angry than I am of the government. Precious metals market, gold and silver have experienced a minor correction. Last week, Franklin adjusted his high for the year, indicating he thought the price of gold could go as high as 1500s or even 1600s. I'm a skeptic. I think there's still a reasonable chance of a larger consolidation in November, particularly if the G20 summit goes well and force is brought to bear in sufficient measure. Now, that said, December has been the high for the gold price 5 out of the last 10 years, and there's plenty of fundamentals as to why that ought to be true as well this year. I've had more and more conversations over the last couple weeks about venture capital. And I want to point everyone here to, we did a wonderful audio seminar in 2005 with Franklin called Building Real Wealth. It's part of your collection. And if you go to the bottom of the cart in the first date in the archive, you'll get a link to the complete collection. And Building Real Wealth is one of those audio seminars. And we also did a great Salieri report with Jay Hughes called Family Wealth. And sort of family, sort of backing and venturing other members of the family is part of that topic. And I encourage you to read those. But the reality is, if we're going to rebuild the economy, we're going to have venture capital. And venture capital at the big venture capital level of the kind that you see go on all the time here in San Francisco, which is really the capital of venture capital, as well as very much at the micro and informal network level. And let me just give you my little speech. I think there are three ways for an individual investor to do venture capital. One is professionally managed. The way venture capital works, you do 30 deals. This is when I was on Wall Street. You do 30 deals, one or two succeed, you lose the rest, but the pool is managed in such a way that one or two make you so much money that you make money on the pool. But that requires a pool, and that requires a serious professionally managed effort. It takes a lot of time. The second is where you're doing venture locally and in your network, including your family. If I bank a local farmer, or let's say I finance land for a local CSA, as we saw in the DVD we watched of The Real Dirt on Farmer John, that I'm financing a strategic resource I need, and even if it doesn't work, I may not get dividends. It doesn't work financially, but I may get food, and I'm learning in the direction that's very important for me to go. And so it gives me a positive return in terms of strategic resources and direction, even where it doesn't work financially. And I often, rather than do philanthropy, I'm often interested instead in doing very high-risk venture capital because I think that in many instances of philanthropy, not everyone, it holds the operation or the enterprise, whatever is involved, to a sustainable vision and business plan because you're looking to put an investment in something that ultimately can charge enough for its products and services to pay its expenses. The third way is similar to the local and network, but it's for your business. If you have a business, financing strategic partners or other people who are providing you, for example, with new technology is something, again, it builds your network, it builds your strategic resource. And if it doesn't work financially, you're still learning and building network in the direction you want to go. And so there's a reason to do the venture yourself. And the second two, when it comes to real high-level venture capital, I prefer to leave it to professionals because you need the diversification of the pool. Now, I have many investors say to me, oh, well, I'm not rich, so I can't do venture capital. Well, you know, you may have time. And right now, particularly if you look at backing young people, the young people in your family or network, it's amazing what you can do with either tiny dollars or an investment of your time. So think creatively because there's a lot of rebuilding of the economy that's going to occur in a much more entrepreneurial mode, whether it's micro venture at the community level or micro venture in the emerging markets or big venture in and ultimately, that's where the great fortunes in the next 10 or 20 years are going to come from. So don't exclude venture, but go at it in a very disciplined way. Some great advice this week, a letter from Simon Black of Sovereign Man. I get his emails, and he was flying to Hong Kong, and the guy he was flying with next to was reading a book on interviews. He started to engage and found out the guy had been unemployed for a while, and was flying over to Hong Kong to get an interview and was all excited about how he had reorganized his resume and was appalled to learn that the guy had spent great deals of time working on a new presentation but hadn't bothered to use the opportunity of his unemployment to learn new skills. And so Simon goes into a rant about the speed at which we have to acquire new skills if we're going to stay competitive in a changing world. And I've been talking with David Lichty, my great partner leading Solaria Silver and Gold, for a while about learning German. And I finally decided, you know, in November I'm just about to drive across the country and end up in Philadelphia. That's a lot of drive time. I can't wait. I got to do this now. So I ordered the Rosetta Stone Level 1 package on German. So we'll see if this works. But I agree with Simon. It's imperative that we maintain high learning metabolisms, and, you know, the future is built by trying something new. Our hero this week, Eliot Spitzer, has been the hero before, who, of course, came back from a, you know, from quite a dust-up in the world of dirty tricks, losing his seat as governor, to launch a new media career. I don't have a TV, but watch him occasionally on the Internet. He seems to be doing very well. But today it was announced that Eliot was rejected by the New York Harvard Club for membership. Now, if you went to Harvard, which Eliot did both undergraduate and graduate, getting into the Harvard Club in New York is pretty automatic. Now, the Harvard Club of New York publishes their mission statement as follows. They say they aspire to create a community that is welcoming, promotes fellowship among its members, and, okay, here's the important line, reflects the spirit of Harvard University. Now, I would say rejecting a former government official who tried to mitigate the housing bubble and hold the people accountable is very much in keeping with the spirit of Harvard, who I would point out, P.S., made a lot of money on the housing bubble. So, Eliot, good work. You got rejected by the Harvard Club. You must be doing something right. Okay, very quickly, and ask Catherine, thank you for taking my question during your last conversation with Franklin. You mentioned something about making sure it is speculative. I don't know what that means. I was referring to if you buy precious metals through a brokerage account, To do so, you may be required to check the box on the form that says you're engaging in speculative investment, and under your bylaws or state laws, depending on the nature of your business, that might cause you a problem. If you buy coins from Franklin or Solari Silver and Gold and store them in a safe deposit box, you don't have to check any box. And that's okay as long as it's okay with your bylaws and any other state laws and regulations that may apply to your business. If you have investors or partners, you want to think through whether that could be an issue in terms of the relationships with them. Okay, when looking at many in the pro-centralization team, they seem to be dull, void of feeling, single-minded, and almost programmed. People like, you know, A, B, C, D, E. Are they chipped, mind-controlled, or just a high-charge power trip? When you're dealing in a situation where there is a real disconnect with resources available and what people have been promised, and you're in an endless series of double binds and sort of a multiple personality disorder society, at some point you can get pretty in your zone and turn off your emotions. And so I won't explore any of the other sort of more sort of covert reasons why people could act that way. But if you look at the sort of the flow that they're managing and the double binds that they're managing, it's very easy to get in that zone. I've worked in that zone. I've been there, and I can tell you it's easy to go there. You're just trying to preserve energy and get the work done. A question, G20 Seoul in November, will the dollar be dropped as a reserve currency? Nope, not a chance. That's my answer. A great question on SIPC insurance, DTCC, and ERISA limitations. And these go to the questions of the disconnect in the securities area between what the paper that is outstanding and what's really real if you did an honest accounting. It's the same issue. If you want to keep funds in an IRA or 401k, one of the things you can do is do a self-directed IRA into real estate or precious metals or other tangibles. So I would check out Entrust and Sterling Trust and the companies that do self-directed IRAs and think about what you can do to kind of pull out of the paper system if that's what you want to do. Okay, so Primal Body, Primal Mind. It's my pleasure to introduce nutritionist and neurofeedback practitioner Nora Gigadas. Nora practices in Oregon. She's the author of Primal Body, Primal Mind, a wonderful book. I was forced to read it much faster than I certainly had it on my list, but I have a dear friend and member of my Solari circle who's one of Nora's patients and who is very experienced in the healthcare area. So this is someone who's had access to superb healthcare, very knowledgeable, and he's so excited about the results he's getting as one of her clients. I was browbeaten into moving that book up fast and was very impressed. So Nora, welcome to the Solari Report.
Well, thank you, Catherine. I couldn't be more tickled to be here.
Well, you and I had a long talk today, and finally I had to tear myself away.
Yes. Yes, and we're going to try to, cram this into a half an hour.
Yes,
this should be interesting.
Yes, we are. Now, I want you to tell the story of how you came to write Primal Body, Primal Mind. You started at 10 pages, and then it just grew.
Yeah, I was working with a young man at a neurofeedback clinic that I was supervising, and he had been diagnosed with ADHD and Tourette's, and we'd been working with him doing neurofeedback and just not getting the kind of progress that we would normally have expected. And one day the kid walked in and his head was hanging down. He looked really depressed, and I kind of said, "Hey, you know, talk to me. What's going on with you?" And he said, "Well, you know, I was ticking again. It was driving my mom nuts, and then she blew up at me, and now she feels bad and I feel bad." And I said, "Well, talk to me about you." I said, "Why do you feel bad? Are you angry? Are you depressed? Do you feel guilty?" 11-year-old boy says to me, "I feel guilty." He said, "I can't possibly know what it's like for her to have a son like me.
Aww.
And she can't know what it's like for me either. And I hate this. I hate this ADHD. I hate this ticking." And he kicks the table and he sits down. And I'm thinking, okay, something's wrong with this picture. So I go out to the waiting room, and I sit down with Mom, and I say, "Mom, talk to me." She bursts into tears. "I don't know what we're doing. Two steps forward, one step back. You know, I feel like we're back at square one." And the light bulb goes off in my head, and I remember, well, I do have another tool in my toolbox. And so I said, talk to me about what this kid eats. And turns out the kid is a total carnivore. You know, he eats bagels for breakfast, eats chips, you know, snacks all day long, you know, drinks sodas and all this other stuff, does not eat a lot of protein, does not eat a lot of fat, quality fat anyway. And I gave her my little homily, the condensed version, and she agreed that, I said, if you can try this for a couple of weeks, you know, we can see whether we can make any appreciable progress. She agreed the whole family would do it together, and they would see what they could do with that. 1 week later, not 2 weeks, but 1 week later, we basically had a normal kid.
Wow.
And mom was in tears again. This time she was extremely happy. This kid ended up, you know, graduating and a student. I was invited to his graduation. You know, he got a black belt in Taekwondo. All kinds of great things happened. And even, gosh, more than 10 years after the fact now, I'm still actually in communication with him. But regardless, I'm digressing. My boss came in to my office and sat down, and he said, I want you to do what you did with that kid with every patient that comes through that door. And so, you know, the next slew of people that came in through the door, I'm trying to talk to them about diet and all this stuff. And, you know, my book, of course, is 400 pages. So you can imagine how fast I was talking. And, you know, people's eyes are glazing over, and, I mean, they're interested, but it's overwhelming. They can't take it in.
Well, I have to tell you, you know, because everybody thinks finance is so complicated. When I first started to try and learn nutrition and healthcare and really take responsibility for my health, I can't tell you how many times I just felt overwhelmed and said, look, this is much too complicated. I can just not deal with this.
Well, we can trade overwhelms, because in the dictionary under financial overwhelm, it says see Nora, so... but anyway, it really was very frustrating because it was just too hard to do it like that. And so I sat down one weekend in front of a typewriter and I typed up a 10-page article that I just started handing out to clients. And they loved that, but I kept thinking, oh gosh, you know, I really should have mentioned this and I really should have said that. And then somebody would say, oh, you know, this was really wonderful, but gosh, you have really some really unique ideas. Where do you get this stuff? And I'm thinking, oh, gosh, I should really need to cite my sources. So I started creating a bibliography. And next thing you know, I had a 100-page manuscript that floated around for quite a number of years. And I did, in the intervening time, quite a bit over the last 10 years or so of really advanced coursework and came to a lot of really unique revelations about things that suddenly just tied everything in together in a way that made me feel like I was holding the Holy Grail. And I finally thought I need to sit down and just put all this down and get it published, finally. And so
you really feel, Nora, when you're reading the book, that you feel the extent to which these things have emerged from working with people and solving their individual problems.
Yeah.
And as you do, patterns emerge. And
yeah.
So it's really evolving out of the success of caring for people.
Yeah, a lot of it really is. This isn't just sort of theoretical stuff. I mean, I do certainly present my own theories as the book goes along, and I think it's pretty clear when I'm doing that. And I also think I present a fairly logical basis for thinking the way I do, so hopefully people can forgive a little bit of conjecture. But I'm also, you know, the book is exhaustively referenced in the back, I don't just make stuff up as I go along.
I do derive my statements
from
now,
legitimate
sources. One of the things we've talked about, and which is so important to us, because on the Salieri Report, we've talked a lot this year about. Our intelligence and how it relates to our health and the sort of the deterioration and the threats to it, whether we've had one on mind control, one on chemtrails, one on HARP. And
yeah,
I know one
stuff.
Of the things you found in your practice is a real deterioration in our neuro operations, if you will. Maybe if you could describe that.
Yeah, and by the way, everybody, you know, the whole issue of the mind-body connection is a myth. It's all part of the same functioning or dysfunctioning system that we have to understand together in context. So you can't have mental health without also having physical health. So it all ties together. But that said, you know, when I started out in the field of neurofeedback about 15 years ago, there was roughly a 50-50 mix of people who wandered in through the door that we would have classified as functionally under-aroused, and the other, you know, half, you know, basically functionally over-aroused or unstable arousal. And as time went on, as the years passed, I started to see a very distinct movement toward the over-arousal spectrum. And so much so that, and it really began, I began scratching my head over this because I'm really watching the entire makeup of the nervous systems of people I was seeing change before my eyes, as, you know, as they kept coming in and the next person is more over-aroused than the last, and I'm thinking, what's going on? A number of years ago, I literally had to trash a $10,000 neurofeedback system because the frequency range I had available to me to train people with wasn't expanded enough to really meet the needs of the majority of people that were coming through the door.
Now, their frequency, what would you call it, activity is dropping?
No. What I see is that frequency, what I'm seeing is that over-arousal is excitatory activity in people's brains is just exploding.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's what I've been observing is that this has been becoming more and more of a predominant problem. And what it's been taking is typically when we have somebody who has higher arousal, we tend to train lower frequencies to help kind of bring that, calm that down and bring it under control.
Okay.
And we're training these frequencies not to try to make lower frequencies happen in the brain, but to kind of ask the brain to watch itself within these lower frequency ranges so that it is better able to optimize its own functioning. So it gets a little, I'm trying to think how involved I want to get in talking about this, but because believe me, I could go off on this. But what I started seeing was a situation where I was having to train lower and lower and lower and lower. And, you know, 7 years ago or so, I was training. Now, I consider the extreme upper end of over-arousal to be conditions like autism or reactive attachment disorder. These are really at the extreme end of the spectrum. And maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I was training those populations at maybe 7 or 8 hertz, roughly in that frequency range. Today, I don't train anybody that high.
Wow.
Everybody is down in the basement. And I understand now that, you know, we're training what we're calling infra-low frequency ranges, which are ranges that go actually below 1 hertz. Or, you know, and what I'm finding with that is that, and what a lot of us are observing, is that there are perhaps some central organizing principles that exist at these infra-low frequencies that we maybe could have benefited from all the way along, that there's something quite powerful about training in these frequency ranges for the vast majority of people, almost everybody. However,
now what has people in this state of over-arousal?
What
causes this?
Well, there are a lot of different things that can stimulate over. And when I talk about over-arousal, I'm talking about sympathetic nervous system dominance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have the autonomic nervous system. There's sympathetic, parasympathetic, and sympathetic, you know, parasympathetic is calm and relaxed. Sympathetic is basically flight or fight.
Right.
And what I'm seeing is that the majority of people walking around are walking around in that state of fight or flight all the time, which we were never designed to be in. There are a number of things that can generate that type of nervous system activity. Obviously, chronic stress of all different kinds, and stress is, you know, whether it be physical, emotional, physiological, psychological, any of that, their stress is, actually stress isn't necessarily what happens to us, it's how we respond to what happens to us, isn't it?
Right.
So, and we see the world, of course, through the lens of things that are our blood sugar to the degree to which we're dependent upon it, which I go over in great detail in my book.
So poor diet can exacerbate this tremendously.
Pardon me?
Poor diet can exacerbate this tremendously.
Poor diet can exacerbate this sort of thing tremendously on a lot of different levels. It could be food sensitivity issues. It could be heavy metal contamination. It could be dysglycemia is a huge, huge, huge source of over-arousal issues. And 99% of everybody you see walking through the streets is really dependent on blood sugar, thanks to the food industry and the way these things get presented, is dependent on glucose as their primary source of fuel,
right,
which isn't necessarily the way we were designed, but it's how many of us are adapted, unfortunately. And so big swings in blood sugar up and down are going to create these surges of sympathetic overarousal, and so a lot of people have that as an undercurrent problem. But I began to question what was actually going on, because it seemed insane to me that we would be driven down progressively to these extremely low frequencies. What could possibly account for that? And somebody I know one evening just sort of mentioned, do you think it could be EMF? Pollution, and I just smacked my forehead and I said, of course, that has to be it. Now, there could certainly be other factors involved, but I think that there is a good logical argument for EMF at least playing a significant role, because what we've seen, you know, 10 years ago, I knew people that didn't have a cell phone. Today, there's almost nobody I know who doesn't have one, and it wouldn't matter whether you had one or not, because cell phone tower proliferation has exploded.
Right.
And nobody's really operating outside the tendrils of that non-ionizing radiation. It's everywhere. And I figured out that I had actually 67 cell towers within 4 miles of my own home.
Wow.
Yeah. So they're everywhere. And we're all being inundated, whether we have a cell phone or are using one or not. And it's not just that; it's the 60 cycle stuff coming out of our electric sockets at home. It's all the electronic equipment that we have. It's Wi-Fi and it's Blackberries. It's all kinds of things.
It's electromagnetic smog.
Yeah, yeah. And we know that, you know, I know that there is an excess of 10,000. Fold increase in this radio frequency radiation or electromagnetic frequency radiation pollution than was present in the environment that we evolved in. And we know from studies of the brain that and done with this that electromagnetic frequency pollution will either generate or exacerbate excitatory activity in the brain. And we also know from studies that EMF pollution, areas that have higher than normal EMF pollution or slightly higher EMF pollution, whatever normal is, will also tend to have be areas in which they're higher than normal levels of autism. So not necessarily as a causative factor, but as certainly a potentially exacerbating one.
Now, one of the things you said is as this dynamic has occurred over time, you're seeing more and more patients whose problem or symptom is exhaustion, not depression.
Right, right. So we used to sort of think of depression as this state of under-arousal. And you know, I've had to rethink that over the years. With respect to the clients coming through now that come in and say, yeah, you know, I'm just really depressed, in essentially every case, to one degree or another, what I'm now seeing is instead a state of anxiety to exhaustion.
Right.
People are just simply burned out. They've spun their wheels in the newly fallen snow to where, you know, the transmission is smoking and everything else, and it becomes a state of learned helplessness. And so these people are just fundamentally exhausted, just burned out. And oftentimes addressing that from an anxiety standpoint.
Yeah, if this happens to me, what can I do?
Well,
what's my action?
Well, it depends on how you're trying to address it. If I'm working with somebody who's a neurofeedback client, my generalized approach, and again, everybody's a little different, but is going to be targeting anxiety more so than depression. With respect to actual depression, though, it has such a complex etiology. For some people, there is a serotonin deficiency. For some people, there may be thyroid issues involved. For other people, there's, you know, adrenal exhaustion. Could be menopausally related. So there are a number of ways in which depression can sort of rear its ugly head, and it my task as a neurofeedback person is a little bit different than my task as a nutritional therapist. And of course, I tend to try to wear both hats. And being a Gemini, of course, I can be two people at once.
I said earlier, one is the gas, and the other is the steering wheel.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And you've got to deal with both.
You do. I mean, one of the things that I like to say is that all the best brain training in the world is amazing. As neurofeedback is, and how I'm actually rather stunned at times the degree to which it can override, people's worst habits and instincts to really bring people to a place of much better functioning. All the best brain training in the world still can't put a nutrient there that's not there. It can't take away some offending substance that doesn't belong. The brain and the body need certain raw materials in order to function.
Right.
Yeah.
One of the things you focused me on this afternoon, I have a dear friend who's always trying to warn me of the importance of gluten and how dangerous gluten can be. And finally, after you explained it this afternoon, I said, okay, I've got to really take this seriously.
Yeah, no lie. I actually have an extremely extensive article on my blog right now. It's called Serial Killer. I thought that was really cute. And you can find it in the Don't Get Me Started section of my blog, and it's exhaustively cited throughout. But this is really one of the great unexplored areas of health at this stage of the game that I think is going to prove to be one of the biggest impacts on public health that anybody ever imagined. Fully, only 1% of people who actually have full-blown celiac disease, which is only one aspect of problems with gluten, by the way, it's not the whole picture, but only 1% of people who actually have full-blown celiac disease have ever been diagnosed.
Wow.
So you have 99% of people wandering around out there with no clue, and 6 out of 10 of them have no gastrointestinal symptoms at all. And celiac is actually being redefined now by some researchers as being primarily, at times, a neurological disorder. It will literally, gluten can affect you all the way from your hair follicles down to your toenails and absolutely everything in between. It can affect your cognitive functioning, your moods, everything about your gastrointestinal tract, and most profoundly, I think, your immune system. And the incidence of gluten sensitivity and celiac disease in the last 50 years has literally risen 400%, and it's not just because it's being diagnosed more. They literally found some blood samples. There was a military hospital where they found the blood samples of healthy young men 50 years ago, and they tested those blood samples for some of the things that they test blood. Now, mind you, I don't consider blood tests even to be the most accurate thing to do these days, but they tested to the extent that they could, and they literally found that based on the samples then and samples of similar populations now, there is literally a 400% increase in the incidence of reaction to this substance. Now, part of the reason for that is, in all likelihood, the fact that the very active genetic modification of wheat, which is one of the most genetically modified foods out there.
So GMO, the presence of
GMO. The
GMO
stuff, yes.
Right.
They've bred a lot more gluten into the grains. And that is part of the problem. Part of the problem is also likely, for those of you that are familiar with Pottinger's cats and the whole Weston Price thing, that our genome has just simply deteriorated to the point where we're just that much more vulnerable to things. But for whatever reason, gluten is a very, very serious problem. And gluten sensitivity is every bit the problem that full-blown celiac disease is. In fact, the unfortunate definition of celiac disease, when they actually diagnose it as a disease, that the microvilli, the little, you know, the shag carpeting on the inside of our small intestines, has to literally be worn flat before they will diagnose celiac disease. So if it's only worn halfway down, or if it's worn three-quarters of the way down, you're not celiac disease yet.
Now, I asked you this afternoon, I want to ask you again, my impression is that our life expectancy is dropping.
Yeah, actually the New England Journal of Medicine recently told us that for the very first time in recorded history, the very first time, our youngest generation has an actually shorter projected lifespan than the generation before them. Shorter. I mean, most parents today are going to have longer lives, longer lifespans than their children. And that's just the reality of things.
Okay, so let's just talk. We have a few more minutes. Let's just talk about what this means to me. What's the action? What can I do looking out at this sort of state of condition of both, you know, sort of what's happening to the people around me, but also the factors that I'm dealing with increased environmental pollution, much of
right.
which we don't understand, you know, whether it's cell towers or HARP or chemtrails or any of these other things.
Right.
What can I do? Give me some quick one-liners on what I can do.
All right. Well, you know, there's a concept in martial arts that you learn where if you're learning how to fend off an actual attacker in a dark alleyway, and if somebody comes and grabs your arm in a dark alleyway, it is human nature to take a look at what is being restricted in that moment and get freaked out. And it's very easy to get freaked out. I mean, all anybody has to do is listen to your show, right? Or read my book, for that matter. But, I mean, you know, we're being inundated with things our ancestors never could have even begun to imagine. And it's really, really easy to get caught up in that. What we all have to do is sort of learn a sort of nutritional martial art technique of becoming aware instead. I mean, noticing what's being restricted. I think it's important for us to be aware of those things. But then focusing on, you know, not what we don't have control over, but what we do. You know, in a martial arts situation, in that dark alleyway, you know, you've got another fist, you've got two legs, you've got lungs, you can scream. You know, there are all kinds of things that you can do to defend yourself and to fend off whatever it is that's restricting you. The same thing is true, I think, nutritionally. And I've heard you say this before, and I love you for saying it, and it's so incredibly true, and so few people get it, that in this day and age, because of everything that we have descending on us from all sides, we literally have to become radical about our health. We all need to catch a good... I think good dose of orthorexia nervosa, you know, that new...
I love this.
Yeah, the healthy eating disorder, yes, that would...
There is, there is a defined term, new mental disease.
Yes.
And it's essentially healthy food disorder. If you're focused on making sure you get healthy food, then you now have this new mental illness.
Right, right. And, of course, it's such a stupid thing to call it healthy eating disorder because that doesn't sound like it makes sense. So they make it sound intelligent by giving it a Latin name.
We don't want your GMO food.
Right, exactly. Yeah, there's something crazy about you if you won't eat. You're not going to eat preservatives. What the heck is the matter with you? You know, so... I mean, really, we all do need to become very radical about our health. We need to become radical about our immune systems. We need to be radical about our own brain function because guess what? Everything about your life, about your experience of life, about the way you feel and function in the world is a result of what is happening in your brain. You've got to take care of that.
But we can retrain our brain. We can retrain our nervous system.
Yes, we have the technology.
Right.
There is that. There's also, You know, we need to also realize that the brain is about 80% fat. There is nothing more stabilizing to the human brain than dietary fat. There is nothing more destabilizing than sugar and starch. The extent to which you can eliminate sugar and starch from your diet, I implore you to consider doing. And again, I go into this in exhaustive detail in my book, but there was a wonderful quote by George Bernard Shaw I wanted to share that says, "No diet will remove all the fat from your body because the brain is entirely fat. Without a brain, you might look good, but all you could do is run for public office." So, yeah, I love that.
Okay, anyway. And one other thing that you mentioned was get tested.
Yes.
I'm a great believer. You know, I get tested constantly. And, in fact, I'm going to get tested with you. So
yes.
I just think getting tested and learning how to read that, getting help reading that,
right,
and sort of tracking where we are is...
Well, and the thing to keep in mind, when you get conventional blood work done, that the lab ranges that your body that the values that come up for you are being weighed against are really not based on anything scientific. They vary from lab to lab and area of the country to area of the country. These lab ranges are really only reflect two ends of a bell curve of everyone who went into that particular lab system for blood work. So you're not getting compared to normal and healthy,
right,
in a conventional
blood.
Let alone
desirable.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
You're getting compared to the guy standing in front of you with the oxygen tank or who is waiting in line for the blood draw, or the woman who is on her second round of chemo, people like that. And as this population becomes less and less healthy, these ranges are broadening daily and becoming less and less meaningful to a significant part of the population that just wants to know, "Doc, how do I compare to normal and healthy?" And, of course, physicians have a mandate. They have to be able to diagnose you with something before they can treat you. So what, you know, their standard of care is to look for what's highlighted at either end of the lab range, and by that point you're in trouble, except with respect to the lipid panels. They've made those numbers, the only thing that they've standardized on the entire blood chemistry report is the lipid panels, because they want to get everybody on Lipitor. Honestly, that's the whole thing. And so those numbers are standardized very arbitrarily, not scientifically, fairly low, so it's going to rope a lot of people in. So don't panic when your cholesterol lights up. That's a whole other subject I talk
there
about exhaustively. I have a good article on my website about that, too.
There was just one other thing I wanted to mention that we
yes.
didn't get a chance to talk about this afternoon. I used to have a pastor who'd get very worked up, and she was screaming at us when she said, "You know, you can have my car, and you can have my house, and you can have my money, but you cannot have my joy." And I think one of the things
there
you're
you
reminding
go.
Us is how, you know, beauty and fun are necessary
yep.
for survival. And we
yep.
have got to find a way, no matter the change, the stress, whatever, to build time in just to have fun.
To keep your brain and nervous system wound down, meditation, massage, you know, biofeedback, neurofeedback, comedies, you know, renting comedies,
right.
you know, just going out for a walk in the woods, taking those time outs
yeah.
are not a luxury, folks. Those are a necessity. This is, you know, part of your preventative health care. These things, just the importance of fostering and cultivating that nice, calm, parasympathetic nervous system functioning cannot be overestimated, because it affects your immune. To be in that constant state of sympathetic overdrive messes with your endocrine system. It messes with your immune system. It messes with your brain function in no small way. And,
we're running over, so I'm going to have to leave it there. Could you just quick give us your URL, how we find you on the web?
Yes, it is www.primalbody-primalmind.com.
Okay, well, this has been a great reminder that there are lots of excellent people out there who are building the pathway through this gauntlet. And, Nora, we appreciate your work. We appreciate your book. We appreciate everything you're doing to keep us healthy.
Thank you, Carol. And really, Catherine, I'm very grateful for the opportunity to be here.
Okay, well, we're in cahoots. So,
awesome.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's go to the movies very quickly. I was watching a friend talk in the late 90s, and I felt a chill go through my back. She was talking about all these delightful things that were happening to her as a consumer, and I realized as her political choices were being drawn and as her freedoms were being withdrawn, they were being replaced by this incredible consumer choice that was part of the bubble, which would eventually probably diminish. And she was literally being talked out of real political power and freedom by being satisfied instead with cars and candidate styles that gave one the sense of freedom as opposed to the reality of it. And then along comes Adam Curtis, who did a documentary for the BBC in 2002 called The Century of the Self. The Century of Self is now available online and also at Netflix, so you can watch it in your leisure, and it's easy to get. There's no better way of, I think, understanding the extraordinary investment that's been made in understanding how to manipulate us. And if you want to build a real immunity to that manipulation, it's very helpful to watch this documentary. It's a really a remarkable work, and I recommend it to you. I also wanted to mention that a wonderful subscriber recommended that I look at The Art of the Steal about the legal battle at the Barnes Foundation in Philadelphia, a remarkable collection that's been in Philadelphia for many years, and we will be doing that. I just finished watching it. It's available at Netflix. I recommend it. We will be doing it. Let's Go to the Movies in the beginning of next year. So if you haven't seen that and you're interested in fraud in the art world, there it is, The Art of the Steal, very well done. In closing, November is going to be hard currency month on the Saleri Report. November 4th, we have John Laughlin from Paris. No more astute commentator on the geopolitics of Europe and the sort of the what's going on financially in Europe. And we'll be talking about will the euro fail? How far could the euro fall? November 11th, more on precious metals. This is the fourth quarter is going to be very intense for precious metals, lots to talk about. On November 18th, Axel Merckx of the Merck Funds on International Fixed Income Markets, one of the most astute money managers in the sovereign bond area. So we're really looking forward to that as well. Don't forget, call David Lichty, Paul Ferguson, or myself at Saleri Silver and Gold. We want to help you diversify your assets with precious metals. Chico, California, October 30th. I'm going to be speaking about Navigate the Falling Dollar, both individual and community strategies. We're going to have a speech in the morning and workshop in the afternoon. That'll be 10 to 3. You can get details under the events section at the website. So until November 4th, when we return with John Laughlin on the euro, we'll be, I want you to remember, don't worry whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.